The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell. I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, business, metaphysics, these subjects that might offer something new that you've been looking for to enhance your life. The two books I'm highlighting today focus on gifts that we don't usually recognize as gifts, such as a complaint and fear. The first book is A Complaint is a Gift by Dr. Janelle Barlow and Klaus Moller, published in 1996. And the second is The Gift of Fear, by Gavin De Becker, published in 1997. So who are Dr. Janelle Barlow and Klaus Moller? Dr. Barlow has been a management trainer and consultant and is the president of TMI, formerly Time Management International, which has clients in 38 countries. Two of her popular courses are The Stress Manager and Unbind Your Mind, The Freedom to be Creative. She's a member of the National Speakers Association and earned the designation of Certified Speaking Professional. Klaus Moller is a Danish business economist and founder and chairman of TMI. His books include Putting People First and Employeeship. At one point of time, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, produced a popular TV program of just about him. So let's look at why a complaint is a gift. If you're in any type of service business, from a store, a doctor's office, a gym, a church, you occasionally receive customer feedback that is considered a complaint. In my experience, if the feedback is good, well, then all is good. But if it's not good, then I have the choice of brushing it off, knowing I'm doing the best I can, or I make a judgment that the customer is not only trying to get something for nothing, or offend me, or use the feedback as a tool to improve our services. Service is an emotional and subjective experience. The word subjective means the complaint is only a person's opinion based on or influenced by their personal feelings. Two people can receive the same service and can judge it as either excellent or totally unacceptable. But the good news is that the vast majority of our customers want our business to succeed. The word complaint doesn't have a positive meaning. It assumes there's something of annoyance or displeasure, or somebody's finding fault or griping and whining. But often it's the only way customers can relay how well they think we're running our business. And, you know, after all, customers are the reason we're in business. The book is divided into three parts. First is how we can shift our attitudes towards complaining customers and understand the value of listening to them. The second part focuses on techniques with an 8-step gift formula for those on the receiving end of a complaint and how to keep our language and interactions consistent with the belief that, yeah, the complaint is really a gift. The third part is examining how to get more feedback from customers by making it easier for them to complain. And then the authors ask, what are you doing about what you're learning from complaints? There are a lot of examples in each section that include some of the most horrid complaints that were ignored, and then examples on the taking the complaint seriously. Dissatisfied customers have two options. They can say something and you do something about it, or not, or they can walk away and you won't even know. In the simplest terms, a complaint is a statement about expectations that have not been met. You got that? If you sell clothing and a customer returns something that didn't work for them, whatever the reason, the customer is giving the store an opportunity to respond, so the customer will be a repeat customer and buy more clothing. At a deeper level, a customer might be testing the clerk or wondering whether the clerk will take their word for it and how the store will compensate them for their disappointment. If a customer makes a complaint by phone, if their call isn't returned for days, they may look elsewhere for service. For a business to see the complaint as a gift, it takes a shift in perception and attitude about the role of complaints in your business world. One supermarket chain back east has large signs reminding the employees that there are only two rules. Number one, the customer is always right. Rule number two, if the customer is ever wrong, reread rule number one. It suggests that there's a buying agreement that if a customer doesn't like what they purchased or if it doesn't meet their needs, they have the right to return it or to say something. That is a customer who can have confidence in the business. One IBM representative sees it this way. The trick is to establish a pipeline from the customer's mind to the salesperson's ear so they can keep track of what customers want and don't want, what pleases or gripes them, so the company can adjust accordingly and stay ahead of the competitors. A manager of General Electric shared with the authors that the task of marketing is to understand the interests of the customer, not to make the customer do what the business is interested in. A good example of this is L.L. Bean, the mail-order sportswear company. When they plan to expand their warehouse space and mail more catalogs out to potential customers, they first studied the merchandise return rate. It was 14% a year. So they decided not to expand and redirected their efforts in making existing customers happier. Merchandise return rates are an indicator of customer dissatisfaction, and it takes up unnecessary space in a warehouse. Another glaring example I'm sure you remember is in 1985. Coca-Cola was blasted with complaints when they put a new product out called New Coke as a substitute for Classic Coke. The public, including me, was outraged and complained loudly, and it wasn't too long before Classic Coke was back. The authors noted that people talk about products they've purchased differently to their family and close friends than they do to people that they're standing in next to in line or in public, people they've never met but who will listen to them, like in a line at Costco or waiting for a plane. Ford Motor Company did a study and found that when someone buys a car and is dissatisfied, they tell an average of 22 people. And if a lot of them are people they don't know, then the lemon story gets exaggerated for maximum effect. In contrast to those who share negative stories, those who are pleased with their car will only tell 8 people, most likely family or friends. Extensive research over the past 25 years reveals that customers mostly speak out about problems that are meaningful to them on issues when they think they can have some impact. This view runs contrary to what many service providers and managers think. In Chapter 6, the authors describe the gift formula. When clerks and managers become so comfortable with the idea that the complaint is a gift, there's no hesitation in their response. They truly welcome the complaint of something of value. How is that done? First, the employees must talk the language of the complaint as a gift. The company reinforces this idea at every chance. So the gift formula has 8 steps, and they are number one, say thank you. There's no better way to make customers feel welcome. And make sure you have eye contact with them and smile and have body language that matches it. It's the basis for a positive conversation. Number two, explain why you appreciate the complaint. Excuse me. Qualify why you said thank you, such as, it improves our ability to improve our quality, or we appreciate you taking the time and trouble to say something. Number three, apologize for the mistake, but not before doing steps 1 and 2. Let the customer get a chance to explain why they're complaining. Saying, I'm sorry, just leaves the customer feeling that nothing's going to be done, and that's why the person is apologizing. Also, using I instead of we sounds more sincere. Number four, Promise to do something about the problem immediately. Do not interview the customer. Service recovery has two aspects, a psychological aspect and a tangible aspect. The psychological dimension helps everyone feel better about the situation that created the problem in the first place. The tangible dimension is doing something to fix the situation. I appreciate that you let me know about this problem because now I can fix it, and I apologize for the inconvenience. I'll get this settled as soon as possible. Number 5, ask for necessary information. In order for me to give you fast service, could you please give me some information? But ask only for what is necessary. Because after a few questions, the real problem may be a bit different. Number 6, correct the mistake promptly. Although sometimes the customer doesn't want anything from you, but if you do plan to take action, do it right away. Number 7, check customer satisfaction. Follow up. Check back with the customer and again thank them for their complaint. And now it feels more like a partnership. And number 8, prevent future mistakes. Make the complaint known throughout the organization so the problem can be prevented in the future. The complaint is not a gift if the company does not use it as feedback to help improve their business. So in the book, this is followed with principles for, I like this part, for turning terrorist customers into partners in a nice way, and how to deal with very angry people. When dealing with an angry customer, you know, you have to remember the complaint is a gift, and this one's just not coming in well packaged, as they say. But you can actively listen to the customer. What I hear you say is, let them express their emotions. We're simply hearing them out. And when they're done, speak to what the customer was talking about. No need to say you're sorry or defend the company. Ask questions which appeal to their emotional state. And their anger will begin to subside, and it's an opportunity for them to focus on solutions rather than problems. This is the reason I really like this book. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners like you and operated by a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. Although, you know, we did have an outage last week. The parts have been obtained and we're back online. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. Or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through the website careasy.org. And if you have any questions, give us a call, 1-530-337-1885. The second book about not recognizing our gifts is The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker. So who is Gavin De Becker? He's an internationally known expert on understanding and predicting human violence. His firm has worked on over 20,000 cases that are rarely seen in the news. Early in his career, he worked as security for very famous people, and he's trained hundreds of police detectives on ways to evaluate domestic violence situations. His clients include the CIA, the U.S. Marshals Office, the Federal Reserve Board, giant corporations, champion athletes, politicians, movie stars, religious leaders, and more. What binds all of their work together is predicting safety and understanding human behavior that leads to violence, which is why the FBI recently hired his company to design an assessment system for screening threats to Supreme Court justices. Not anything I would have thought about. Wow. The reason I like this book is he makes it simple. When it comes to fear, he writes that there are only two rules to remember. Rule number 1, the very fact that you fear something is solid evidence that it is not happening. It isn't happening, or you'd be doing something about it. It's our intuition signaling fear that something might happen. And if it does happen, the fear stops and we start responding to it. We surrender to it, manage it, or we begin to fear what might happen next. Rule number two, what you fear is rarely what you think you fear. It's what you link to fear. For instance, if X happens, then our mind links it to what if Y happens, and then what about Z? Yet here's the thing. Worrying about something won't stop it from happening, but worry will interrupt our clear thinking and can waste our time. De Becker addresses many women's issues in this book. He explains the power of our intuition and how women can recognize pre-incident indicators and use survival signals to protect us from violence. He offers his knowledge on how to understand threats, how to deal with people who are too persistent, dealing with violence in the workplace or domestic violence. For single women, he explains date stalking, and he includes research on violent children, acts against public figures, and so much more. The human brain is never more efficient or invested than when we are at risk. Then our intuition escalates and our awareness jumps from 1 to 100 in an instant without our really knowing why. The root word of intuition means to guard and to protect. So he asks the reader, how many times have you followed one course of action and later said, I knew I shouldn't have done that? It means we received a signal from our intuition and we didn't follow it. We know that dogs follow their intuition all the time, but a human's intuitive abilities are vastly superior. The problem is when we get an intuitive hit, judgment can step in and we disregard it because it doesn't seem logical. The mental energy used to find an innocent explanation for something could be used to evaluate the environment around us for important information. What is it that we're not seeing but we intuitively feel? I'll share a personal example. I've always avoided waiting in line at gas stations. So one day I'm driving up Hilltop Drive and my intuition clearly said to pull in that line, which put me at third in line at the Chevron station by the Red Lion Hotel. My logical mind said, Mary, you never do this, but I did it anyway. So I'm sitting there and I hear a woman crying hysterically. I look around and she's in the phone booth when they were still phone booths at gas stations. I got out and I approached her and asked if I could be of help. She said her car broke down and her son was at Waterworks Park and she's late picking him up and he's probably very worried. Well, I told her my name and that I'd be happy to take her to get her son. So I pulled out of that line and away we went, and she was extremely grateful. And by the time we got back, the mechanic at the gas station, when there were mechanics at gas stations, was able to fix her car. I'll always remember that because the voice in my head was so loud. But when it comes to violence, human beings are competitive and territorial and can become violent just like our caveman ancestors. We can tell ourselves we would never kill anyone, but then we add a caveat, unless a person tried to harm someone we love. So the potential for violence is in everyone. All that changes is our level of justification. Research shows there is one thing that does predict violent criminality, and that is violence in one's childhood. De Becker shares that during his own childhood, he became focused like a laser beam on predicting, worrying, and predicting when his parents might get violent and hit him. He learned to be a moving target, focused on the future, and that immunized him against the pain in the worst moments. Looking back, he writes that the things that would frighten most people now could not distract him as a boy, because he had become so familiar with danger that it no longer set off an alarm in his mind. A characteristic of predatory criminals is their perceived need to be in control. Most violent people grew up in a chaotic, violent home. And at a minimum, it's a home where parents do not act consistently and reliably. A place where love is uncertain or conditional. So controlling others becomes the only way to predict their behavior. You know, not all people with awful childhoods become criminals. History shows that from artists to scientists to presidents, one can overcome a past and be a valuable contributor to society. In Chapter 4, he explains survival signals. He reviews a case where he helped a woman regain confidence and courage after she was violently attacked. The woman was coming home after dark, carrying groceries up to her apartment building, and she noticed the door of the building was unlatched. She was glad she didn't have to get out her key. She closed the door behind her and heard it latch. But while walking up a flight of stairs, one of the grocery bags gave way and cans of cat food tumbled down the stairs. A man's voice called out, "I've got it. Let me help you. Let me give you a hand." She didn't like the sound of his voice and declined his help, but he insisted and she relented. He seemed so friendly. She opened the door of her apartment and thanked the man, but he insisted on coming in to help her. A couple of hours later, after a violent experience, she was able to escape. But ever since the experience, she felt deep fear every day and she could not sleep. She contacted Gavin DeBecker, Inc. Due to DeBecker's knowledge about the patterns of violent criminals, he was able to explain some of the survival signals she had unconsciously picked up and used to make her escape. Understanding her intuitive ability to pick up the survival signals, she was able to regain her confidence and courage. One way to reduce our risk is to learn what risk looks like. The face-to-face criminal is an expert at quickly building trust with the victim. The first signal is called forced teaming. The criminal uses the word "we," like "we got a hungry cat up there" as he's picking up the cans of cat food. It's an effective way to establish premature trust because a "we're all in the same boat" attitude is hard to rebuff without appearing rude. But forced teaming is intentional. It's a sophisticated manipulation. The criminal projects a shared purpose, like, "we're a team, both of us. How are we going to handle this?" It makes the victim want to participate. Survival signal number one, forced teaming behavior is inappropriate. Survival signal number two is charm and niceness. One way a criminal charms a victim is to smile and be nice. But niceness is a decision, a strategy. It's not a character trait. Charm, along with a deceptive smile and unsolicited niceness, has a motive behind it. Number three, the criminal who wants to deceive someone often uses the simple technique of giving too many details to the victim. Like in the case mentioned, the criminal said things like, "One time I was supposed to feed my neighbor's cat and I forgot," and on and on and on he talked. Since it doesn't sound credible to the criminal, they keep talking to distract the victim from the obvious. Survival signal number four is typecasting, where the criminal labels a victim in some slightly critical way of hoping they will feel compelled to prove that the opinion is not accurate. Here's an example. "You're probably too snobbish to talk to the likes of me." Or, "You don't look like someone who reads a newspaper. That would really offend me." Typecasting always involves a slight insult, and usually one that's easy to refute, but it is used to establish a dialogue. Number five is loan sharking, where the criminal wants to help you because that would place you in their debt, that you owe them something, and it makes it hard to ask to be left alone. The signal is that the criminal approached you and you didn't ask for help. Now they just may be a kind stranger, so be on the lookout for other signals. Now, all or any of these signals are used daily by regular people who have no sinister intent. So it's the intuitive part of us to recognize when someone approaches, are they steeped in deceit and manipulation? Number six is the unsolicited promise. In the case previously described, once the criminal was helping her carry groceries into her apartment, he said, "I'll just put this stuff down and I will go. I promise." DeBecker writes that this is one of the most reliable signals because it nearly always shows questionable motive. Why does a criminal do this? Because they can tell that you're not convinced, that you have doubt. And your defense when someone says, "I promise," is to immediately think, You're right. I'm hesitant about trusting you, and maybe with good reason. Thank you for pointing this out. Of course, then take action. Number 7 is discounting the word no. This is one of the most universally significant signals of all. When a criminal discounts or ignores the word no. Many times a short word like no is said tentatively or without conviction, like, oh no. No is a word that is never negotiable. It's a complete sentence. The person who chooses not to hear it is trying to control you. If you let someone talk you out of the word no, you might as well wear a sign that reads, okay, you're in charge. De Becker suggests that a woman alone who needs assistance is actually far better off choosing someone and asking for help, as opposed to waiting for an unsolicited approach. The person you choose is nowhere near as likely to be a hazard as the person who chooses you, and it's much safer to ask another woman for help when needed. You know, I hadn't thought about this other comment he makes until I read it. De Becker says that women who jog along in the park with their smartphone enjoying music through their earbuds have totally compromised their ability to recognize survival signals. Her hearing and full vision are distracted, and the earbuds display her vulnerability for everyone to see. You know, our intuition is always right in at least two important ways. It's always in response to something, and it's always got your best interest at heart. But he clarifies that intuition is always right, but our interpretation of intuition is not always right. Our intuition is always learning, and everything it communicates is meaningful, and it will not waste your time. The messengers of intuition include nagging feelings, persistent thoughts, anxiety, curiosity, hunches, you know, those gut feelings, doubt, hesitation, suspicion. You know, I hope you've enjoyed some of the wisdom in these two books. If you're in a business, the gift of a complaint is very valuable. And I do encourage every woman to read The Gift of Fear, because I've only touched on part of the personal safety information he shares. Use this information for good in your life and the lives of everyone you love. And for those you don't love, heck, use it for their good anyway. It's another small step in bringing peace to the world. I encourage you to do that today. And I thank you for your ongoing support of KKRN, your nonprofit community education station that operates with 100% volunteers. It's truly an amazing station, offering a wide array of good programs that would not be operating without your financial support. And, you know, early I said in this talk that the station was down. Well, you're probably hearing this a month later, so it was down in August. But, you know, we had help from the Chico community station. We had help from our wonderful volunteers, and the parts were purchased, and we went back on the air. And Ellen, bless her heart, she worked so hard on this. So thank you, Ellen, if you're listening. You know, the music for this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses, and it comes with a full-color brochure on their adventures. So until next week, may peace be with you, and enjoy a bit of time left on this program for the music.